If you haven't been paying attention much to the state of play of American politics lately, you might be surprised to learn that discourse has become a lot rougher, especially since the election of President Donald Trump. Mary Catherine Hamm and Guy Benson have been tracking this phenomenon for a lot longer than Trump's been in office, and they've come to the conclusion that spirited debate often gives way to personal attacks. These conservative thinkers join us on the latest edition of the Politically Speaking podcast to discuss this phenomenon and their book, End of Discussion. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, a candid conversation with the Show Me State's biggest political newsmakers.
I'm Jason Mirzenbaum.
And I'm Joe Manis.
That's Eric Greitens, Navy SEALs running for governor, and I'm really, really glad to be on with you, Jason and Joe.
I'm going to push back on these regulators.
I'm doing this for the people.
I was encouraged along the way, not just by my family, but by a lot of teachers and professors, and knew when I was in college that I would run for office someday.
We're very excited about the prospect of having some more free market solutions.
Even though after the conversation, I still might not agree.
We want our listeners to get a real sense of what drives these people.
They're actually people with a story to tell.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio today is...
colleague Joe Manis.
We have two special guests today. I don't think either one of them has ever lived in Missouri, but they're in Missouri right now to talk about their very fascinating book. We have in studio today...
Guy Benson.
And...
Mary Catherine Hamm.
Two conservative luminaries. I've been following... you, Mary Catherine, for years.
Oh, thank you.
And you went to my wife's college, Northwestern University. And as
yes,
I mentioned in the green room, I thoroughly enjoyed your Political Beats episode on Billy Joel. So
thank you. Go Cats. And I love Billy Joel.
And we'll talk about that a little bit
later.
You've
already made him so happy.
I know, you know, the purpose of this show is just to make our guests feel super happy and flattered about themselves.
Yeah. So then they just say anything.
No. Just it's sort of like the frog in the boiling water. So we're going to make sure you all say things that are horribly controversial and end your careers.
Yeah, because the water starts out cold, if you remember. The water starts out cold.
Now, enough of that. I want both of you to explain who you are, kind of give a brief synopsis of your careers, and then we'll get into why you're in St. Louis. First, Guy.
Sure. So I'm the political editor at a website called townhall.com, which is a conservative online publication. I'm also a contributor at Fox News Channel. And starting May 7th, I'm going to be co-host of a new national radio show through Fox News called Benson and Harf with my co-host Marie Harf, who's a former spokeswoman for the Obama administration. Sort of right and left, we were friends. We don't always agree. So that'll be fun.
So sort of a Hannity and Combs for the new generation.
Millennial Hannity and Combs, a lot of mutual respect and friendship, and kind of like a modernized version of that in some ways. And from time to time, I fill in for David Brooks on All Things Considered on Fridays. So it's cool to be at public radio here in St. Louis.
Yeah, I always joke when we have conservatives in NPR, like when you enter the doors, you don't just spontaneously combust.
Yeah, but here we are.
Yeah, you are here.
Well and
came
good.
Close.
It was a close call. You know, we are radioactive. Mary Catherine, if you want to just explain your bio as well.
Yeah, sure. I started out as a newspaper journalist, fourth generation newspaper journalist from a news junkie family, although not a particularly political one. My dad was a newspaper man my whole life.
That's great.
And then ended up sort of going to journalism school, came out of journalism school, worked in a newspaper for a bit, and then ended up going just sort of into policy. Worked at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, editing a journal for a while, and then sort of stumbled my way into new media and writing online when that was a new thing, into YouTube videos when that was a new thing, and was able to make a path for myself in new media, and ended up being a Fox contributor for a while, and now I'm a CNN commentator, and co-moderated an ABC News primary debate in 2016.
Yeah, now this is fascinating because it's good to see how younger people are able to make careers in journalism and news these days, because I think it's a lot tougher. I mean, I thought it was tougher when I was getting started. It's nothing like it is now.
Well, I will say, I think it is nice that there are more outlets that you can try. And I work at The Federalist, which is an online outlet as well. But I will say what I miss for younger people is that entry-level newspaper job at a local newspaper where I just really had to put my nose to the grindstone and figure out who everyone was and cover all the beats, and
Night
I think that
Police.
Was a very good introduction.
What was
to
your
news.
Entry-level newspaper, Joe?
At the Post-Dispatch, it was Night Police. You had to do that.
And I was, my entry-level job into newspapers was not terribly entry-level. I was the state government reporter for the Columbia Daily Tribune.
Nice.
It was pretty rare for a 22-year-old to get that job, and it was a great time. But we're not here to talk about ourselves. We're here to talk about your book. And forgive me, what is your book called? Just want to make sure that I get it, that the title right.
End of Discussion. And there's a long subtitle, as every conservative book
has. I think that's why I think...
Yeah, in fact, I was looking...
It's required.
I think that's kind of why I asked you all to say it. My understanding, it's kind of about this tendency in modern political discourse to not necessarily debate issues, but to basically go after your opponent in a very ferocious way before the discussion even happens. I've noticed this happens on the left. I've noticed it happens on the right. I'm not sure if it happens in the center very much because the center is very touchy-feely. But,
well, there isn't that many people left in the center.
But explain what your book is about and kind of why you guys decided to write about it, because it's a topic that I've, as I kind of mentioned in the green room, I've been noticing well before Trump, but I think has become even kind of more top of mind now.
Sure, although I would briefly push back about the point on the center, because I think there are these radical centrists who are very end of discussion-y and bullying in the way they discuss matters. The political director at ABC News comes to mind, Matthew Dowd, who is just horrible about this stuff. And he's, you know, a country before party raging centrist, but he rarely engages in actual substantive debate. Was not planning on taking a shot at him on the podcast, but
there you have it.
I did want to push back a little bit.
Well, that's why you have to challenge assumptions like that.
Totally.
You know? So, but continue.
But yeah, so the general thesis of End of Discussion is that the left, primarily but not exclusively by any stretch, is increasingly seeking to win debates, quote unquote, win debates, cultural debates, political debates, by preventing those debates from really happening and sort of disqualifying the other side by questioning or demeaning motives and then saying, well, these people are de facto evil or dangerous and therefore unwilling or unworthy, rather, of serious debate or consideration. We initially came out with the book in 2015, 1 week to the day before Donald Trump announced he was running for president. So his name did not appear in the original edition of End of Discussion. We published a new edition this past August, paperback, cheaper, and a new chapter, including Trump and sort of the Trump effect, and how we're noticing as well our side very much saying, well, the way to fight back against left-wing End of Discussion is to do it ourselves and punch back twice as hard, and that's something that we caution and argue against.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, I mean, I would say that conservatives do this just as much. I'm, as far as pushing back or not wanting to discuss certain things. I mean, I have a lot of conservative relatives, and they don't want to. You know, there is no discussion. I mean, and I agree with you that it's also that way on many liberals as well. It seems like neither side really wants to have a discussion. It's more they want to shut each other down, I think.
And the reason, just to maybe explain a little bit more, the reason that we lay this a little bit more or significantly more at the feet of the left is because, culturally speaking, a number of the most powerful and influential taste-making institutions in America are dominated by the left. So,
for example,
academia, most of the mainstream media, and certainly pop culture and Hollywood. So there's an amplification and a legitimization of when the left does it, whereas we absolutely do it on our side. We, in our book...
Like, ooh, we're like super mad about Starbucks cups, but the correct and overarching reaction to that silliness is, oh, that is silliness, instead of let me legitimize your silly outrage. So there's a difference in how that gets amplified and weaponized.
Well, give me some more examples of this. Like, we had David French on our podcast who talked about shutting off debate in college campuses, like people being shouted down or people protesting people that were controversial. And in his mind, that runs counter to the idea of free speech. And if you disagree with somebody, you should go hear them talk and you should challenge their ideas in the ways that you're kind of mentioning. And it was a very compelling case.
Yeah, well, and as I've mentioned before, and I mentioned when he was here, a lot of this, it's like what comes around goes around. I mean, because I'm a lot older than the three of you. And I remember when there was this similar type thing, the end of the late 60s and early 70s. Part of it was tied to the tensions over the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. But the result was, I mean, you had many prominent members of Richard Nixon's administration, for example, who might go on a college campus, and they would be shouted down and they could not speak. And I don't think it was great then, and it's not great now. But it's interesting to me as an older person to watch kind of everything reinventing itself. It's just different people doing it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and there was a bit of this we talk about in the book, a bit of this in the 90s as well, sort of as part of the sort of birth of the first version of PC, yeah. Right? But it was not as, we argue, it was not as weaponized. It was not as organized. It was not as bent on punishing people. It was like, look, this is the right way to talk about things, but we're not necessarily going to take your job away for not talking about them correctly. Now we're in a different era. And our argument, much like French's, is that, who we like and respect, is that more speech is better. And it actually is an increasing trend on college campuses. I just looked up the stat today from another colleague of ours, Kirsten Powers' USA Today column, which noted that disinvitations and uninvitations or cancellations of commencement speakers in the 20 years before 2009, there were something like 21 incidents. And then in the 5 years after that, 39 incidents. So it is a real bad trajectory. And we argue, look, nobody is owed a platform. Your school doesn't have to give someone a platform, particularly if they're a private institution. But once an invitation is extended, we should have the courage to stand up for wanting that person to speak, for making sure that that person has the opportunity to speak, and that the people want to hear that person, get to hear that person. And we have this argument instead of the no platforming, instead of the shouting down.
Well, the one example that's come up lately is Kevin Williamson in The Atlantic, which I'm sure both of you are very familiar with. And for our listeners, Kevin Williamson was a longtime writer for the National Review who got a job at The Atlantic. And it was kind of a newsworthy because The Atlantic, I think, is, I would say it's a center-left publication generally. And having a conservative voice in there was kind of a notable thing. Well, what ended up happening was he didn't really end up getting to write for The Atlantic because there was a lot of outcry from abortion rights activists based off his comments that he made. I don't know if it was in jest or whatever about hanging women who had abortion. I don't know the situation that well, but I think that people, especially Williamson's defenders, saw that as an example of not willing to engage in his ideas in a forum that's not traditionally conservative. Some of his detractors will say, well, he's responsible for his own statements and he's not owed a platform. So I know that's not written about in your book, but since that's I think that's a tangible example that's happened recently. I'd be interested to hear what both of your takes
was on
that.
My main takeaway from that is if you hire Kevin Williamson, who is an acerbic writer, an incisive writer, mm-hmm. I think a really interesting and, yes, provocative writer, which is what they were looking for or claimed to be looking for. When you hire him and you think about hiring him for a long time because you anticipate, no doubt, a firestorm, once you get the controversial acerbic writer and you have to answer for some of his controversial and acerbic statements, you should have the courage to do that because that was the reason you brought him on. And I think caving to the heckler's veto actually creates a situation where you have more people with less outlandish speech who get pushed off to the sides because people don't want to stand up to the mob.
Yeah, Jonah Goldberg wrote, I think, the best piece about the Williamson episode, saying that once Jeffrey Goldberg, no relation, hired Kevin to The Atlantic, he knew what he was getting himself into with Kevin Williamson. He's a caustic guy and a brilliant writer, and I agree with him a lot of the time and disagree with him some of the time, and sometimes agree with him but think he's saying it in such a provocative way that it turns me off. But he was a known commodity that was hired. The Atlantic did not have to agree to publish anything or everything that Kevin chose to write, but firing him for his thoughts or his beliefs, and in this case, it was more of an intellectual exercise about the morality of abortion in Kevin's mind. He was an unwanted pregnancy in 1972, the year before Roe, and so he views this as a very personal issue to himself, so he's talking through the implications legally of if you were to criminalize all abortion, what would that look like? What if it is a form of homicide? What's the punishment for homicide? So he tweeted a little bit about it. It was on a podcast. he's mostly skeptical of the death penalty generally. So to me, it did not ring true as a calling for the hanging deaths of any woman who has an abortion. But he was talking this through, this brain process, out loud in public, and said something that, of course, I very much disagree with. Even as a pro-life person, it's nowhere near my position. To me, having that thought and going through that exercise, it was distressing that that became a fireable offense. The mob did not want Kevin Williamson to have that job, and they were latching on to various thought crimes and things that he had said through the years. That was the one that they finally got him on. But I do find that there is this resentment among some of the sort of lefty mobs online whenever a conservative breaks out of the conservative sort of media ghetto and goes mainstream. Some of the tweets that I get when I'm on All Things Considered, there are people who do not want people who think the way that we do, broadly speaking, to be legitimized or mainstreamed into their media outlets.
I mean, and this is going to sound like an obvious question, but I want you guys to talk about it, not me. What is the benefit of allowing, let's say, somebody like Kevin Williamson to keep that job, or to allow this kind of more open discussion on volatile views?
That's a great,
on both sides.
No, it's such an important question. So I'll start briefly, which is I think that people can be better at understanding what they really truly believe or don't believe when they have to think them through. And sometimes that involves being challenged by, yes, radical or extreme people. It's a clarifying exercise in some ways. And then just on a personal level, when I arrived at Northwestern as a college freshman, I was sort of a check-the-box right-wing, down-the-line conservative because I was introduced to politics through conservative talk radio. I stumbled upon it one day when I was trying to listen to the Yankees game and they were rained out or something and Sean Hannity was on. I was like, oh my gosh, what is this? When I got to college, I then had to defend my viewpoints. I was often outnumbered by liberal students. And we would have these long, messy, I'm sure problematic and all sorts of issues, types of discussions about issues and policy questions and cultural stuff. And we were not making polished, perfect arguments, but we were going back and forth. And it was an enriching experience for me as a human being. It made me understand better where some people were coming from. And it, frankly, made me understand, okay, I'm actually maybe more conservative than I thought on these three issues, but maybe I'm not conservative at all on these other three issues, and I need to reconsider. And I ended up sort of joining the left, or at least the libertarian-ish left, on a couple key public policy questions. And I don't think that that growth or evolution of my thinking would have been possible in an environment where everyone is on eggshells and pins and needles about saying everything the exact right way or else you might be reported to the safe space czar or whatever. That would have made my college experience and my intellectual journey poorer and worse. And I want that same thing for current undergrads. That should be an enduring value.
Yeah, I think the way we think about news being the first draft of history, I think your high school and college education and the ability to have these conversations and be confronted by different views is sort of the first draft of your ideological personal growth and who you end up being intellectually as a person. And if you're not allowed to mess up that first draft sometimes, if there is no allowance for that, then you aren't going to grow in the way that Guy's talking about. And it does sound cheesy, but we say it everywhere we go. Is that both of us grew up confronted by different views than ours a lot. I grew up in a very liberal town. I'm sort of a natural contrarian. Ended up being conservative because of some public policy issues that I, as a nerdy kid, honed in on when I was very young. And I just liked to argue with people. I liked to poke holes in things. I liked to hear someone's explanation for why this is the way the world is or should be. And it was so much fun. And it was so enriching, and it gave me real relationships with people who think crazy different things than I do. And that was just so valuable to me that it makes me sad to think about dorm rooms where you can't have that free exchange, or think about high schools where you're afraid to have that exchange. not that you want to be actively rude, which is another thing we argue against, which is a tendency of some in the non-PC movement.
Yes, we are not pro-rudeness.
Right. No, okay, that's not our thing.
It's good to hear.
but that you can have those and have some leeway for each other and give each other some grace. And the idea that we're losing that is sad.
Can I just make one other quick point? Because we've talked about the weaponizing of this political correctness, which is one of the themes of End of Discussion. An example, it's not just college campuses. This is now being people graduate and they move into the real world, and it's starting to be this mentality exported into American life in other realms. And one of our frustrations was a number of months ago, there was the whole the dust up at Google with the engineer who wrote an internal memo involving women and STEM and an insular culture, and he was fired for writing this internal memo. And Mary Catherine and I stood up for him and said, this is End of Discussion culture. Google as a private company had a right to fire him, but it was not the right thing to do. And a bunch of conservatives said, yeah, right on, you're totally right. And a few weeks later, President Trump said, we should be firing NFL players who want to kneel during the national anthem. And the same people who were standing up for the Google guy were like, yes, yeah, fire those players.
And that was going to be what I wanted to talk about next.
Yeah, because that was my point from earlier. Is that you see this on both sides.
Sure. And no, the impulse is the same.
Where do you see that? What do you think started all this?
I think it's, I mean, as Guy was saying, it's a human impulse to want to trample
the people
who disagree with you.
But as I mentioned, there's in waves.
Yeah.
What do you think is responsible for this current wave?
One element of it is social media. Mm-hmm. And look, we are not Luddites. We are not opposed to social media. In fact, we use social media and leverage it all the time, and I'm pro more platforms, right? But it is easier to whip up a mob on Twitter than it ever has been before in terms of boycotts and at least giving the perception of widespread outrage over something, to which businesses and entities sometimes cave in our argument way too quickly, way too easily. And going back to the right versus left thing, the firing the NFL players, that's just one example of, I think, the reason Donald Trump was so successful in the Republican primary was a fed-up attitude among many right-leaning Americans with this political correctness and this bullying. And a lot of them said, and we talked to them throughout the campaign, they would tell us if they're going to, paraphrasing, if they're going to bully us and tell us we're horrible people for who, we're going to hire a bully of our own and we're going to let him do some of our dirty work for us. And Mary Catherine and I really don't think that that's the ticket to improving anything, because it's sort of a downward spiral.
I want to provide a specific example of something Trump did when he was in St. Louis in 2016. Now, obviously, maybe both of you know, St. Louis has been the epicenter of major protest movements over police and how their tactics are. First in Ferguson, most recently in Stockley. In St. Louis with the Jason Stockley case. And some of the protests have been provocative, if not downright violent. And I'm not condoning violence in any form. I want to make that very clear. But many of the people that adhered to a movement to change how police do their jobs were at a rally with Donald Trump, and they protested. And when you protest at a private event, you're going to get thrown out. Not saying that's a free speech. That's not what I'm trying to say here. What ended up happening, though, was Trump basically pointed them out and said, these people, and I'm paraphrasing here, these people are the worst of America and they don't contribute anything. And basically was delegitimizing pretty clearly their what they were trying to do. And I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that, because there has been kind of an effort, I guess, more on the right to basically say these protests, which largely include African Americans and their allies, are illegitimate for a lot of reasons. And the violent protests are illegitimate. I'm not trying to say that. What I'm talking about are the protests that are provocative, that may disrupt, but are not violent. I'd like to hear your opinion on that.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree with Trump on this, and we argue publicly that you shouldn't discount entire movements of fellow Americans, say as, what's a phrase, baskets of deplorables, for instance.
Yes.
Yeah. As contributing nothing to society, what have you.
The way the Tea Party was treated rhetorically by many on the left.
Like, this is a bad habit. And it may be effective in the news cycle at that moment. And it may be effective in that moment to have the president be your bully and to make those claims. It's very bad for society, because And one of the things we note in the book is as the rise of Black Lives Matter happened, I believe that was what it was focused on, polling among conservatives or right-leaning identifying people just got egregious on questions like, should public officials be able to publicly criticize law enforcement? And suddenly conservatives were like, nah, that should be illegal. And we were like, nope, 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 nope. That's not a thing. That's not how this works. That's not how a free society works, which is what you allege you believe in. So these things are very bad tendencies, and you don't actually get to solving any problems. In fact, there's a pretty prominent and growing younger, more libertarian conservative faction, and many with actual support in the Senate, Mike Lee and Rand Paul, for instance, who are aligned with the left on many criminal justice issues.
I was just going to say, there is a pretty prominent faction, strain, right. Group of conservatives who agree with like a lot of the policies
that the
Black Lives Matter movement has. They may not agree with the protest tactics, and I would hope that they don't agree anytime there's property damage or violence. But, you know, having covered this now for 3 or 4 years, I have noticed that there is this kind of knee-jerk reaction when they make their grievances to just completely reject them out of hand because of their tactics without listening to what they have to say. And I've noticed that. I'm glad to hear that you don't particularly like that, because I wouldn't approve of that if it was a conservative movement either.
Right, so. And I would argue you would very quickly see a much more even vocal liberal faction argue against the Tea Party if they were, say, lighting bakeries on fire. Like that would not go over well.
No.
And so it's important to draw those lines and make distinctions. There are people or parts of movements who do bad things. That does not discount an entire movement of your fellow Americans who happen to maybe disagree with you on some issues.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is some of this, and this is kind of a theory I've had for, is that some of this tied to a wave of social change that maybe is not tied directly to politics, but then impacts it. For example, either... obviously the movement, there have been various ways of civil rights movements. There was a lot of marches in the 60s and different things. Some of that, because of Ferguson 4 years ago, was kind of rekindled. Then you've got, of course, the women's movement, I think, has gotten rekindled the last year or two. Some of it's the efforts for more rights, or at least make it more, I don't know how to explain it, but for people, you know, not criticizing people who are not straight, you know what I mean? Just letting people live their private lives not discriminating against people on that. Is some of this tied to that, do you think, where there's some frustrating things? I think I'm thinking in terms of generations, where not all older people, I think in many ways, some of the baby boomers may be more sympathetic because many of us were young in the 60s. But the generation right behind us, if there's some resistance or some upsettingness about what they see in the social front, what people see on the economic front with jobs going overseas and that sort of thing, does that then, do you think, feed into some of the political frustration or not? Or is that separate?
I think we're cross-pollinating a number of different phenomena there. I just think that a younger generation is, and by the way, it's not by any stretch even most millennials or younger.
Right.
It's a sizable and growing minority of young people who believe that being exposed to and hearing ideas that they don't like is a violation of their rights in some way. And therefore, they have every right to make sure that that does not happen. And the conflation of problematic or uncomfortable speech with violence is one of the themes that we run into a lot. And I think it's a very dangerous one, because in some cases, like we've seen in Berkeley, if you conflate speech with violence, you can then justify violence to shut down speech. And that's not good. And when you are even using it more... sort of philosophically and not literally on this front, just talking about, oh, your words are doing violence to me, or your words are doing violence to marginalized communities, and this whole web of intersectionality, it is, in my view, a way to short-circuit views and shut down real discussions by saying it's out of bounds, it's beyond the pale. And when some things are out of bounds, some things are beyond the pale, using the N-word, for example, this is a consensus.
Right.
When you take that principle and you appeal to that good in people to not want to needlessly offend others, and you abuse that and you expand it far beyond the appropriate bounds, you're going to get a backlash and you're going to get a lot of people who are resentful and angry at what you're attempting to do and the suggestion that you're making about who they are as a person. And I think some of that resentment resulted in the rise of the alternative right, the alt-right, and separately but quasi-relatedly, Trumpism, which is not to say Trump equals alt-right. That's not the point
right,
I'm making.
Right.
But when people feel like legitimate differences cannot be adjudicated in a fair-minded way, they will gravitate toward more extreme voices who are willing to buck the trend in a deeply provocative and sometimes counterproductive and occasionally evil way.
Yeah, and I would say I just wrote today about an example of just, you know, in 1990, how different things were and felt. Barbara Bush was invited to Wellesley to give the commencement speech
in 1990. In fact, I watched it online just before the show.
It's a lovely speech. It's actually a quite quotable speech to this day. At times, a surprisingly ahead of its time in a feminist way speech.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And she gave it at Wellesley, but Wellesley students objected to this. About 150 wrote a protest letter to the president. It got covered in the New York Times, national news. Notably, they did not ask her to be uninvited. They just said, we have a problem with this. We think as a homemaker and a stay-at-home mom whose sort of career is defined by her husband's career, she doesn't embody what we learned here at Wellesley. We'd prefer to have Alice Walker, the author of The Color Purple, or any other number of people. And the head of the school said, okay, I understand the back and forth we're having here. I think it's a bit of a generational gap. She didn't have as many opportunities as you do, and I think she has things to say. But this conversation is valuable. Barbara Bush said, I get it. I am from a different generation, but I think I have some same things to share. If you'll let me have this conversation with you, we can do this back and forth. She goes, she gives the commencement speech, which, as I noted, is surprisingly feminist at moments. In fact, hinting at a future female president.
Yeah, it's a great line.
In a very funny way. And the protesters' concerns were heard. She was able to speak. The majority of the students who wanted to hear her heard her. And you got this very inspirational speech that young women are still inspired by. And so I think that the productivity of that back and forth is what we've lost. People were able to object and loudly and get national coverage, but it wasn't this need to say, I'm sorry, Mrs. Bush, you must shut up and sit down now. And so everybody got to have that conversation instead of what we see, you know, in increasing numbers now.
For my final question, do you see this getting better or you see it getting worse, especially as Trump continues to be in office? I'd be interested to hear your thoughts for the future.
It depends how much I'm on Twitter on a given day.
Yeah. Sometimes, I mean, to be candid, I love Twitter too, but I've actually shut my phone off after 6 because I'm just so sick of some of the negativity. And I'm sure both of you are, considering you have probably 10 times as many followers as I do. But I'm interested to hear what your prognosis is for the future.
So I would say that I'm not terribly hopeful, but there are forces, and we talk about academia a lot, particularly because that's sort of where some of the newfangled terms and some of these trends sort of turn up in the first place.
Well, what do you see as a way to change that?
Well, I'll get to it. So on the academic level, you see some college professors getting together and saying, hey, we need to actually sort of, I don't know, something like a bill of rights for academia that would say, for instance, that freedom of speech is very important, and this is why we back it, and we'll stand up for people who want to engage in it. So I think setting those boundaries and making clear where they'll put their feet down, I think is very helpful, and it's helpful for students to have that guidance. I think the fact that people are now thinking about how they consume Twitter and social media is helpful, because I think each of us in the modern era has to be responsible for that and what we spread and how we're talking with friends, and perhaps, I don't know, having in real life discussions more often opposed to online.
It's amazing how great they are.
So those things are encouraging to me. And then I think on the entertainment front, we've seen a lot of comedians, for instance, speaking of first drafts, they're on stage improv-ing, right? And they say, oh my gosh, we can't do our jobs if everybody's going to have a video camera and try to make us lose every job we've ever had as soon as I say something objectionable. So a lot of comedians, Bill Maher, Jerry Seinfeld, well, it's
Chris Rock,
have pushed back on this notion and said, hey, like, can we chill out a little bit? Because I would really like to be able to perform and create some new art and to have the ability to make mistakes while I do it. And I think appealing to the American people, particularly millennials, on the fun front can really be more convincing than other fronts. And so I think there are places where I see bits of light.
Yeah, and just my one thing is Jonathan Haidt, who's a professor at NYU, he's done a lot of work on this. He's on the center left, and he is concerned, and he does push back against his fellow liberals' denialism of this problem. He's actually quantified it in a number of ways. He started a group called Heterodox Academy, which a lot of professors around the country are raising their hands saying, yes, this is a problem. The faculty at Middlebury, for example, many of them signed a statement after there was a terrible incident there involving violence where a liberal professor ended up getting sent to the hospital in a melee over, you know, a speech that never ended up happening from a conservative academic. So the fact that it is that there are some alliances being built across the ideological spectrum is very important, because this becomes it's a loser for the country if free speech and the free exchange of ideas is a partisan thing that only conservatives complain about, and only when it's the other side that's doing it. It has to be self-aware and self-policing on both sides, who can link arms and say, my goodness, we disagree completely, you and I, on abortion, on immigration, on tax policy, on healthcare. But the only way we're going to ever have a chance to solve or resolve some of these tough challenges in a remotely productive way is to be able to actually talk about them without instantly impugning the other side's motives and shutting it down. So that's why Mary Catherine and I come around the country to places like St. Louis to talk about it, because we think it is an existential question for the Republic.
Well, we want to just thank you so much for taking your valuable time to talk with us. This is a really important issue, and I'm not just saying this to flatter both of you. As journalists, and especially people who talk to people with a divergent sets of opinions, I know we're not supposed to advocate for anything, but free speech and allowing people to be heard, even people who have very vile views sometimes, I think is an important thing.
Are you allowed to advocate for people to buy our book, End of Discussion, on Amazon?
Yes.
Excellent.
But I'm saying this because I feel like the sentiment that you're getting across is very important. I would say that if you two were very far to the left, or even in the center, hypothetically.
And we enjoy joining forces with all of them. So,
So how can people follow you on Twitter or any other parts of the World Wide Web?
At Guy P. Benson on Twitter, same on Instagram, public profile on Facebook, and you can read my work at townhall.com and find out more about my new radio show at bensonandharf.com.
Did somebody take Guy Benson first?
Oh, yes. It is a left-leaning attorney in Washington, and he hates me. I feel like I've occasionally gone to his Twitter feed just to look at what Guy Benson is up to, and it does seem like an enormous amount of his tweets are just telling people that he is not me. I'm like, dude, give me the handle. It's too much of a hassle.
That is an unfortunate situation. How can people follow you on Twitter? Or
I'm at MK Hammer, and no one else has that name. On Instagram, and MK Hammer Time. And so you can find me both those places, often goofing off, but sometimes talking about politics.
Joe, how can people follow you on Twitter?
Okay, it's Jay Manis. It's Jmanies. Very basic.
You can follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. You will succeed. That's my punchline. But before we go, I want to just go around the table and just get everybody's favorite Billy Joel song. And we're going to reach a consensus, and that will be our outro music. Joe.
Still Rock and Roll.
Mary Catherine.
Keeping the Faith.
Only the Good Die Young.
I would go with She's Only a Woman.
These are all excellent suggestions.
So maybe we'll just play them all at the same time and make all of our listeners
nice mashup,
deaf.
It's better than Silence.
It's also better than Sounds of Silence by Disturbed. That's not a great song. Even though many Missouri politicians like it.
I like the original.
I like the original, too. We'll come to a consensus, but until next time, so long.
Thank you.
Come